Hello and welcome to the Awaken to Wholeness Summit. I'm Valsa Lidker. Today is absolutely one of the most important conversations that we can have in this particular moment in time. And I'm really excited that we're about to dive into something so rich and needed in this world. It's one that invites us into the collective dark night of the soul and into the essential nature of life here. It's my deep honor to have with us Andrew Harvey and Carolyn Baker. And I want to tell you a little bit about both of these amazing people so you have a sense of the incredible work they've been doing in the world. Andrew Harvey is the founder and director of the Institute of Sacred Activism, an international organization that invites concerned people to take up the challenge of our contemporary global crises by becoming inspired and effective agents of change. Sacred activism is a form of compassion in action that is born of a fusion of a deep spiritual passion with wise, radical action in the world. The large-scale practice of sacred activism can become an essential force for preserving and healing the planet and its inhabitants. Andrew has taught at Oxford and Cornell University, as well as various colleges and spiritual centers throughout the world. He's written over 30 books, including The Hope, which is this beautiful guideline for sacred activism. Carolyn Baker is also the author of many books, including Love in the Age of Ecological Apocalypse, The Relationships We Need to Thrive, as well as Collapsing Consciously, Transformative Truths for Turbulent Time, and so many other books, recently Dark Gold, The Human Shadow and the Global Crisis. She lives and writes in Boulder, Colorado. She's a former psychotherapist and professor of psychology and history. Carolyn is also a life coach and spiritual consultant for people who want to live more resiliently in the present as they prepare for the future. Her podcast, The New Lifeboat Hour, airs weekly online. Carolyn and Andrew Harvey have recently released their collaborative book, Return to Joy, a very important book for our time and one that we're going to dive into today, right now. So important and just such an honor to have you both with us. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for doing this wonderful work.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, we're all being called right now. And, you know, you guys really are incredible guides for us and prolific writers and just incredible messengers of this time. So I'm really excited to dive into all of this. You know, I was thinking about there's just so much that we can talk about. And your new book, Return to Joy, I feel like it's this like culmination of all the work that you guys have done. It's like all right here, you know, and how do we really stretch our capacity to hold the depth of grief that's happening in our world and ground ourselves in the deep joy that is always present within us? And I want to invite us to dive into that. And to start, I'd like to just share a little bit about the both of you and how, you know, what broke your hearts open? What brought you into understanding that the essential nature of life is joy? Please share.
Well, I would like to just say that I met Andrew back in 2009 after I had written my book, Sacred Demise, Walking the Spiritual Path of Industrial Civilization's Collapse. And shortly after that, I sent him my memoir, which is the story of my personal journey and the things that broke me open, which pretty much had to do with being raised in a radically fundamentalist Christian home. Lots of repression, lots of trauma, and lots of repression of my sexual orientation, and going to a religious school as a result of that and getting kicked out of there for my sexual orientation, and just a tremendous amount of suffering. As I was going down this really dark spiritual path, and my life had to fall apart so that I could find the light. And it wasn't an easy path. It wasn't a linear straight line path at all. But in the process, I found Carl Jung, who was just such an amazing teacher for me, and did a lot of years in Jungian therapy as a client. and really developed out of that a spiritual path which holds the light and the dark. And I really learned in that process how important it is to embrace the heartbreak, to embrace the darkness and the shadow, because those take us to transformation if we will stay with the work. And if we will do that work in the support and the loving arms of other people who can walk that journey with us. So that's kind of in a very small nutshell, what has happened for me.
I feel you, Carolyn. And Andrew, how did your path unfold with all of this? You've had an interesting childhood as well.
Well, I think everything began for me in India. On the one hand, India is the most sacred country, and I was introduced very early as a child to Hinduism, to Buddhism, to my parents' Christianity, and I realized that there is only one divine and that there are many paths to the divine. So I think that's what woke me up mystically and began me on the path. But India also is a place of tremendous tragedy and suffering, and I never ignored as a child the pain that I saw on the streets, the beggars and the mangy dogs and the air of great sadness and desolation that hangs around those who live deprived and dispossessed lives, and that seared my heart. I then plunged into England and education and God knows what and became a professor of Oxford when I was 21, and all seemed to be going well, but I had a series of devastating love affairs, which left me very sterile and barren and heartbroken. And I went to India when I was 25, again, to return to India, and had a series of overwhelming mystical experiences, which began the search that's produced all my work. So that's what opened me to God. I realized that God was real and that I was a part of God and that my consciousness was potentially a divine consciousness. I plunged into the mystical path very intensely for the next 15 years and was initiated into Sufism, into Buddhism, into Hinduism, and into the depths of Christianity. But it was really in my 40s that I began to wake up to the unfolding tragedy of this global crisis. I began to understand that the whole human race was on a path to suicide and matricide. Suicide by creating a totally unsustainable fantasy of industrial civilization, and matricide because the civilization that we've created is annihilating the earth. What was frightening was how few people seemed to be awake to this. So it was very thrilling for me when I finally met Carolyn's work, because in Carolyn's work I could find exactly what I was looking for, someone else who faced the potential of our extinction, faced the full horror of this tragedy, but not capitulated to paralysis or despair, found a way to stay buoyant, to stay loving, to stay serving, to stay joyful. And I was so really overwhelmed by reading Sacred Demise and her other books, which I devoured, that she became very important to me as somebody that I knew I could always talk to. It's very important on the path, especially now, to have people you can talk to from your heart, because so many people are in such denial. And it's sometimes very difficult even to begin a conversation, a serious conversation, about these very serious issues. I think the thing that is most broken open my heart is my love of animals. I think the fact that I love cats so much, and I've had the joy of having some amazing cats who've been my beloveds, has opened me up to the horror of what's being done to animals. We're living in a worldwide Auschwitz in which we're torturing the animal race to death. By 2020, the World Wildlife Fund has told us that 2/3 of wildlife will be gone. And I've been working over the last years very much with the white lions of Timbavati, the great Linda Tucker who guards them. And that has absolutely bitch-slapped me awake to the truly horrific plight that animals all over the world are facing, not just in the hunting sense, but also in the abattoirs. We kill 57 billion animals every year to feed ourselves, and this is an atrocity. So the combination of understanding that we're in environmental collapse and that we are acting out in barbaric ways and mutilating and destroying the creation and murdering animals in horrible ways and seemingly not caring that we're destroying species after species has really shattered my heart open. But just as Carolyn said, I found from my own inmost experience that heartbreak does not lead to paralysis. Because at the center of the deepest heartbreak, you find, as Rumi tells us, a fountain of deathless passion that never runs dry. And the deathless passion is to do something, is to serve what you're heartbroken about. And I found that when you turn up in radical service, you're flooded by mysterious joy, the mysterious joy that rises up from the depths of being. And what I've understood from my mystical experience is what all mystics come to know, and that is that the fundamental nature of reality, the fundamental nature of God, the fundamental nature of this whole cosmos is a boundless, serene, tender, fiery bliss. And once you've experienced this bliss and really been flooded by it, as I've been graced by the Beloved to do many times, it remains always in you. And Carolyn and I believe very deeply that unless millions of us now turn to this fundamental primordial joy as the core of the nature of the divine and as the core of our own nature, we simply won't find the wisdom, the courage, the love, the stamina, the energy, the deep peace, the surrender that we're all going to need to be able to go forward in what could be an extinction crisis. It seems strange to say that even in these terrible times, you can find joy, but I've found that it's actually these terrible times that drive you into the depths of yourself where you do find this amazing fountain of passion, and intertwined with that passion, rising from that fountain, a great and deathless joy from which you can go out and give yourself freely to the world again and again.
Well, I'd like to just underscore this holding of joy alongside the darkness. One of the things we talk about in the book is the difference between joy and happiness.
We are
a happiness-addicted culture. And so if you get the right boyfriend or the right girlfriend or the right car or the right house or the right career, you'll be happy. And so our culture is trying to sell us happiness 24/7. Happiness is very superficial because it's circumstantial. When those things that make us happy go away, then we're not happy anymore and we're lost and we're sad and we don't know what to do. We turn to an addiction of some sort or whatever. And so what we're pointing out is that this joy, which is at our core and is the ultimate nature of our reality, is always there, that we can access it. We give a number of practices in the book of how to access this joy. And we give some examples in the book of people who have exuded joy throughout their lives of suffering. You know, we talk about Viktor Frankl, who survived the Nazi Holocaust, and he wrote so much about, you know, man's search for meaning, and he had the term tragic optimism. And he was talking about holding together these opposites of joy and sorrow. And there are many other people in the book we talk about. The Dalai Lama. We talk about, you know, Malala and Jane Goodall and many others who...
And don't forget Tina Turner. We talk about Tina Turner because I couldn't write the book about joy without mentioning Tina Turner, who went through absolutely everything.
Yes, yes.
Horrible marriage, horrible racism, everything you can spell, and emerged this wild, gorgeous phoenix radiating the most rugged, robust joy. What a sign of what the true nature of this journey is.
Absolutely.
Like here we're talking about joy as like the ultimate subversive act. You know, right?
Yes.
We're just told and shown and conditioned, as you were saying, Carolyn, too, you know, to always be seeking happiness. And that we're not happy and we're not worthy and we're not good enough unless we have this car and this thing. And, you know, we're always trying to upgrade into happiness somehow.
Yes.
Yes.
Really root ourselves into joy, this ever-present state. We recognize that everything is here right now.
Absolutely.
No matter what's happening in the conditions of the world, inner or outer, the joy is always present. So it's like revolution.
Into yes.
Well, and it is the ultimately subversive act. That's my favorite sentence in the book, because I've discovered that, and I'm sure everybody listening knows, that part of the way in which this very dark culture works is to make you constantly anxious and then tell you that your anxiety can be healed by consuming more or becoming a star or appearing on Oprah. And this is a disgusting cycle which keeps people trapped in the very superficial part of themselves. What you discover when you plunge deep into any kind of sacred practice, and what you discover when you plunge deep into any kind of authentic service, is that you will discover this tremendous joy at the core of yourselves. And this is not dependent, as Carolyn said, on whether you're rich or poor or famous. This is your and my nature. This is what God has given us as an original blessing. And it's this that truly helps galvanize you and continue to keep you active in any circumstance. I had a vision about 10 years ago when I was given in the vision the words networks of grace, which is how I believe things will be organized in this terrible time. Groups of people coming together to really help each other, encourage each other, and actually do something. And at the same time as I got the words networks of grace, I saw a banner unfold in the sky, and I knew it was the Christ consciousness that was unfolding this banner. And the banner had these stunning words on it: joy is the power. And when you really contemplate those words, what comes through is that it's not only that we're being given this joy, this glorious, tender, blissful joy at the core of our nature, and that it can bubble up if we train to really attend to it, but that this joy gives us power. And it gives us power because the divine creates all the worlds with this joy and through this joy. And once you connect with this joy, you're given a portion of the power of the creativity of God. And this is not poetry. This is something both Carolyn and I, in our different but absolutely related ways, experience. And this is why Jane Goodall is still smiling, knowing everything that she knows. This is why the Dalai Lama bubbles up with the most radiant cheerfulness, even after leading his people into exile and suffering genocide and seeing quite clearly, as he does, the horrible situation that we're in. This is why Desmond Tutu overflows with lavish, extravagant fun. This is why all of the great nurses and doctors in the emergency rooms are not in despair. They've got this quiet joy as they go about their work. This is why many, many activists who also know how terrible the situation is still have tremendous joy in the core of their lives, because they know the great secret of life, which is that if you really want to be joyful, give yourself over to a cause much larger than yourself and serve it with everything you have. And the reward to those who are crazy and sane enough to do that will be joy.
Amen.
You lay it on him, brother.
Yes,
true though. This is the truth that you long for everybody to discover. This is why I think being a teacher sometimes is so hard, because you're not asking people to go through all the ordeals of the past simply to wear the badges of suffering. You're asking people to go through the ordeals of the genuine path, to have their heart broken by the truth of the world, so that they can discover this joy and then start working from it and start dancing with it with their life.
Yes. And the key is there to allow our hearts to be broken open. You know, it sounds so simple. Turn to the joy. It's all right here as we're saying it. And yet we seem to be...
Well, that's the new age version of finding joy. And we've written a very new, un-new age book, because we know that the real joy can't be found without the real heartbreak. They come together, they're sisters.
Absolutely.
What is important is to go beyond the heartbreak. Let the heartbreak carry you beyond it, just as the crucifixion does not end with Jesus mangled on the cross, but with Jesus erupting into a wholly new dimension and radiating the light of that dimension through every proton and quark and neutrino of the universe, so you'll discover that if you dive deep into the abyss of your heartbreak, you won't drown. You'll be beached by the mystery of grace onto a shore in which you'll experience a joy that you never imagined possible. And with that joy intact in your heart, you can do anything.
And I would like to say just a bit here about how important it is to confront the myths and the distortions that our culture has given us around grief.
Yes.
The man who wrote the foreword of our book, is one of the, I would consider him the grief sage of North America. He's written a wonderful book called The Wild Edge of Sorrow. And he regularly does...
Apprentice to grief, right?
Yes. And he regularly does grief rituals. He talks about creating an apprenticeship with sorrow and seeing grief as the doorway to transformation. We have to confront these false notions about grief, just as we have to confront the false notions about happiness and joy in our culture. And just an example, you know, last week when Debbie Reynolds died a day after Carrie Fisher, you know, I went to the CNN website, and the headline was, grief and sorrow can kill you. And I'm looking at that and I'm going, well, yes, it can. And that's not the whole story, because we have so much phobia in this culture of grief. Oh, I can't get near that because I'll have a heart attack, or it will kill me, or I'll get clinically depressed, or I'll get stuck in it. And so we need instruction and we need guidance in how we carry grief and joy together. Mary Oliver, the poet, says, "Grief and joy, what a time these two have, housed as they are in our own bodies." Mm-hmm. And so we need to touch the grief, the heartbreak that Andrew and I are talking about, and allow that to take us to the joy. And it will. Mm-hmm. I know that.
I want to read that fabulous poem we put in to the book by Jewel Matheson. It's long, but it so gets to the core of it. Can I do that?
Please do.
Yes, please.
We have come to be danced, not the pretty dance, not the pretty pick me dance, but the claw our way back into the belly of the sacred sensual animal dance, the unhinged, unplugged, cat is out of its box dance, the holding the precious moment in the palms of our hands and feet dance. We have come to be danced, not the jiffy booby, shake your booty for him dance, but the wring the sadness from our skin dance, the blow the chip off our shoulder dance, the slap the apology from our posture dance. We have come to be danced, not the monkey see, monkey do dance, 1, 2 dance, like you, 1, 2, 3, dance like me, dance, but the grave robber, tomb stalker, tearing scabs and scars open dance, the rub, the rhythm roar against our souls dance. We have come to be danced, not the nice, invisible, self-conscious shuffle, but the matted hair flying voodoo mama shaman shaking ancient bones dance, the strip us from our casings, return our wings, sharpen our claws and tongues dance, the shed dead cells and slip into the luminous skin of love dance. We have come to be danced, not to hold our breath and wallow in the shallow end of the floor dance, but the meeting of the Trinity, the body, breath, and beat dance, the shout, hallelujah, from the top of our thighs dance, the mother, may I, yes, you may take 10 giant leaps dance, the ollie, ollie, oxen, free, free, free dance, the everyone can come to our heaven dance. We have come to be danced, where the kingdoms collide in the cathedral of flesh, to burn back into the light, to unravel, to play, to fly, to pray, to root in skin sanctuary. We have come to be danced. We have come. That's such a stunning poem, because it shows you in the language how heartbreak actually can make your dance fiercer, wilder, more passionate, more energetic. Heartbreak opens you to the pain of the world, to the injustice, to the cruelty, to the madness. And when you respond to that madness with love and the desire to serve, then your dance becomes a divine human dance. You dance like Sheba dances, creating the world. You become one with Jesus as the Lord of the dance. You become one with the mother who is dancing all the world. And people now have to know this to be able to begin to stand what is now unfolding on the planet without going stark, raving mad. Mm-hmm. And nobody will be able to continue to work and to serve whatever happens unless they make the real radical, passionate effort to ground everything they are and everything they do in this great joy. That's why Carolyn and I have written the book in the way we have, really opening up the nature of reality, but then showing that it really requires holding the dark and the light and being very clear about the enemies to joy that have been established in our culture. And I think this is perhaps the most important part of the book, because when you truly realize how our death machine culture has been set up in so many ways to destroy the access to joy, you come to believe that this is a kind of conspiracy against preventing people to be radically empowered by the joy that lives in all of us as a blessing from God.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what, as you're touching on that, the saboteurs of joy, I think we should talk a little bit more about that. You know, what we're talking about, okay, we have this deep sense. I mean, that poem just like pulls me like right into the heart of it all, you know? If you're not falling in love at the end of that, and just like, it's incredible. Right. So what is up against us? You know, because we have tapped into this space. We live from this space. We work from this space. We are in our sacred activism full on. There's a lot of people out here who are just hearing this for the first time, who are wanting to break free and feel this wildness, you know, being danced. So what is up against us? What can we look to recognize that can help us become more conscious of how we can come into this joy for ourselves?
Well, one thing that is up against us is a trend now that is worldwide. It is not just in the United States, but is worldwide. And we see this in every situation where societies are collapsing. I've been writing for 10 years about the collapse of industrial civilization. The collapse of industrial civilization is happening everywhere in the Western world. And what often happens when civilizations begin to collapse is they take a very hard right turn. And so we're seeing this in Europe, and we're seeing this in the United States. We're seeing a wide movement of neo-fascism. And that is part of what we're up against right now. Extremely patriarchal, really kind of crazy, chaotic, but increasingly authoritarian, the cult of personality, and absolute war on vulnerability and poverty and service and people in need. And so times are getting increasingly dire. We're looking at a planet that is in a headlong trajectory toward extinction, potential extinction of species, including our own. I have a very difficult time imagining that there will be any humans on the planet by 2100. Some people say much sooner than that. I don't know. I'm not into the numbers. But we are heading in that direction. And we have now in front of us in the United States and throughout the Western world, you know, new faces, new politicians who are taking us further in that direction because of their ignorance, because of their denial of climate change. And so this is not an us and them situation. I want to make that clear, that we have to have compassion for their ignorance as well. But at the same time, we need to become spiritual warriors and learn these tools of that we've put in Return to Joy, that also we put in our recent article, which was published on Huffington Post, The Serpent and the Dove, in which we're talking about four things that we're going to need to get ourselves through this time and survive and thrive. The first is reconnection with ourselves, with each other, and with Earth. The second is resistance. The third is resilience. And the fourth is regeneration, really consciously intending and making it a part of our intention to leave something for this earth, for whoever survives after we're not here anymore. So we have a hell of a lot of work to do. And this is what Andrew and I are about right now in our writing, in our teaching, because so many people are walking around in despair and fear about what's going to happen in 2017. What's going to happen with this Trump administration? How's it going to affect me? And what do I do? And so in our sacred activism efforts, we are endeavoring to give the support and guidance that people are looking for.
And the kind of guidance that we're offering is not soppy new age, it's all going to be fine, and all you have to do is to sit on your expensive cushion and send sweet vibrations to the world. That's absolutely bankrupt. Right. And one of the things that we really do is to ask people to confront the saboteurs. There's so many of them. We have a scientific fundamentalism in place, which tells us that the cosmos has no meaning and that to have any kind of sense of God is ridiculous and absurd. A great deal of the culture is saturated with this very, very superficial and trivial atheism, which has really become a kind of fundamentalism. We have the corporate fundamentalism in place, which tells us that our ultimate goal is to be robots in the death machine, well paid, but so overworked that we never have time to enjoy life. We have a new age fundamentalism in place, which says to us, oh, the dark isn't real, the light is the only reality, and that if you just have positive thoughts, everything will change. This is radioactive horse shit and has proven itself completely bankrupt. But of course, in a time as desperate as this, people will believe anything, especially if it helps them avoid confronting the situation and confronting heartbreak. We have the fundamentalism of fun, which is a very dangerous kind of fundamentalism, because we're kept endlessly entertained. A kind of morphine drip of pseudo-fun is poured into our veins at all moments to allay our anxiety just enough to keep us vaguely happy in a kind of boring way, but not really in touch with the kind of joy that could impassion us and give us the energy to resist and transform the situation. And when you look at all of these things, it's not surprising that the tragedy of our time is unfolding in the way it is, and perhaps the deepest tragedy of this tragedy is that so many people feel so disempowered and paralyzed when they actually start to wake up. Instead of taking the horror of the situation and using it as a challenge to rise up and do something, people have been so weakened by these various fundamentalisms that we discuss that when they actually are confronted with reality, have no inner strength, no inner tools. And Carolyn and I are doing absolutely everything we can at the moment to give as clearly and as concisely and as precisely as we can all the tools, and I mean all the tools, that we have found to be really, really effective in our own work, because we know how absolutely essential it is to get this message out to as many people as possible, which is another reason why we wrote the book in the way we did. The book is extremely profound, I hope, and it's very concise and condensed, but it's very simply written. And this is something we worked very hard to do, because we truly believe that this book could be read by absolutely anyone with an open mind and heart and really help start the great return to joy that will make the rising of the phoenix of resistance possible.
And it really is a great invitation to fall in love with life so fiercely that we can't possibly sit still and do nothing. You know,
absolutely.
Like, recognize ourselves as part of this earth, this cosmos. When we see it all as like an extension of our own bodies, then we absolutely have to stand up and do something about it. Otherwise, we feel the suffering of the world within us. We do. That's what moves us.
And this is a very important point you just said, to fall in love with life. And one of the other saboteurs that we go into is the way in which all of the patriarchal religions and mystical systems have become addicted to transcendence, have become addicted to an otherwhere. They either talk about this world as an illusion, which is obvious rubbish. I mean, talk about illusion to the people suffering in Syria. Talk about illusion to the animals going extinct. Talk about illusion to the whales that are being polluted. This is an obscene negation of the reality, the divine reality of the created world, and it's an obscene degradation of the sacred feminine. The universe is a sacred marriage between transcendence and immanence, and all the forms born out of the light, and all forms born out of the light are born out of the light, all the forms born out of the light are sacred. And unless we have this great restoration of the healing and all transforming powers of the sacred feminine, we're going to be stuck with this obsession with getting out of this world, with this world as an illusion, and the point of life being not about living here with tremendous love and passion for justice, but going to heaven, which is such a negation of the truth of our created world and prevents millions and millions and millions of people from truly loving their lives and therefore protecting life. This is a great tragedy, and we go into it in very fierce details to alert people for the need for a new cosmology, for a new celebration of life as divine, because it's only this celebration of life, of the creation of animals, of grass, of trees, as divine, that can lead us to find the joy that will give us the power to protect our creation.
One of the big kahuna fundamentalisms that was not mentioned, but I know a little bit about, is right-wing Christian fundamentalism. Actually, the fundamentalism of the right wing is really kind of recent. It wasn't until about 150 years ago that this whole notion of a rapture, Jesus coming back literally in the clouds, taking people up to heaven, was born.
And only straight white people, apparently, right?
Yes, of course. And so this has become very popular, not surprisingly, in a right-leaning culture, because it's all about answers and certainties. And again, as Andrew was talking about a moment ago, he was referring to something else, but you can also say this about Christian fundamentalism, which is this world is nothing. We're here to dominate and control the species. Man has domination over everything, and it doesn't matter if we wreak havoc on the earth, because we're all going to leave. We're going to go to heaven with Jesus in the rapture, and you know, the earth can go to hell in a handbasket, doesn't matter. And the only thing that matters is to have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Don't get involved with your neighbor. Don't try to do any service. Don't try to make things better on this earth, because they can't be made better. And this is a very theocratic kind of fascism that has really put Trump in power, I believe. It's really
81% of the evangelicals voted for Trump, for this man who negates absolutely everything that Jesus stood for. Yes. And this version of Jesus is an unbelievable blasphemy, considering that Jesus, who nobody loved life more than Jesus, and nobody fought for justice with more passion than Jesus, and nobody cared more about sacralizing and divinizing life, the body, the mind, the heart, than Jesus. And to erect this terribly banal and stupid philosophy and to cling to it in the name of Jesus is really, to me, completely baffling. I don't know how they can read the Gospels and come up with this garbage.
Well, because they're not really reading them.
Right. They're being told what to see, right? And what to believe.
Not understanding.
Closed systems. Like, no information can come in because it's based on quote unquote faith.
Yes.
No, nothing rational, nothing that brings you into the experience of the divine for yourself. Nothing.
Oh God, no, that's the last. I remember once talking to an evangelical pastor and mentioning the verse in John in which Jesus says very explicitly, "You will do greater things than me." Meaning, you can't make Jesus into some idealized, remote son of man, son of God figure. You have to really accept Jesus' challenge to Jesus yourself. That was his real message.
Exactly.
Don't worship me. Become your own unique, gorgeous version of me. Yes. And the all the churches silenced that, which is one reason why that tremendous message of joy in action has been so hobbled and sterilized. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've been doing in these last years is really bringing back the original Christian message, the original vision of the Christ consciousness, which is extremely joyful, extremely suffering, and extremely radical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
Absolutely. Wow. And just taking it all in right now, because this is big. This is a big message and a big invitation. And in some ways, it's really an invitation for us to feel and to question the things that we think we know, you know, and
God, I think we've got to question everything we think we know, because what we've been told is a lot of lies about everything. And it takes a very brave person to do so. But the truth is that there are many of us who have been questioning for years. If you want to wake up, the material is available. If you want to truly start doing something, the map is there. If you truly want to discover joy, you have at your fingertips all the great treasures of the mystical traditions and all the practices that can enable you to experience that joy. So really, we have no excuse to go on being slaves of a clearly apocalyptically dangerous system. We must now wake up and take back our power and work with joy to transform our world before the dark destroys it.
And just to remind ourselves of the real literal meaning of the apocalypse, it's a Greek word that means the unveiling. Mm. And so right now, millions of things are getting unveiled. And the more veils we can rip off and see for what it is underneath those veils, the more consciousness and clarity and power we're going to have.
Yes.
Well, this may be the great gift of Trump's election.
That's all.
Instead of lying on the floor and howling and indulging in the great orgy of pity, self-pity that's happening all over this country, people should start celebrating one thing, which is that the shadow that we've all been inching around is now blatantly out there.
Yes.
Anyone with half a mind and half a heart can see that this man and the group of billionaires and crazies that he's assembled to rule this country are people who are putting into practice and will put into practice everything that will ensure our destruction. So the most important thing that anybody could do now is to see that clearly, and instead of being driven to paralysis, start doing the inner and outer work that will empower them. And this is what Karen and I are dedicating our remaining years on the planet to empower a great nonviolent revolution of love in action.
Yes.
A couple of years ago, in a conversation with Andrew, he talked about writing a book on the shadow. He said, "You, Carolyn, you really need to do that in, you know, with your experience and what you bring to." So I wrote Dark Gold, The Human Shadow and the Global Crisis. And I just want to put in a plug for that book, because it's exactly what Andrew is talking about in terms of what is the American shadow? What does it look like? And how do we transform it? How do we transform our personal shadow? How do we transform the collective shadow? And again, in this book, I've put a lot of practices, tools for us to use to actually do that.
So let's talk about that. I want to talk about the personal shadow.
Sure.
And the collective shadow. Let's get an idea of what it is that we don't know, that we can't see, that's behind us, right? That shadow, we experience it, but we don't know it. So let's talk about that.
Sure.
Well, it's very important to understand that. And we've put a great deal about the shadow into Return to Joy, because both of us know that the ultimate saboteurs of our joy are the shadows that the collective crisis is emanating, and also the shadows in ourselves that collude with this collective crisis. Isn't that so, Carolyn?
Absolutely. And in Dark Gold, what I define the personal shadow. And the personal shadow is really any part of ourselves that we send away, that we say, this doesn't match with my ego image of myself. And we don't do that consciously. We do that unconsciously, which is why it makes our personal shadow so treacherous. And we do the same thing as cultures, as groups, as communities, as nations. Oh, we're not that, you know. It's those people out there who are violent. It's those people out there who are racist, and so on and so on.
And we should also say that the things that we feel very triggered by,
Yes.
To start looking at the
absolutely.
Really get to rise out.
Well, look at terrorism. I mean, we go on and on about Islamic terrorism, and of course it's horrific. But what about the terrorism that our bombs have inflicted on the Iraqi population? What about the terrorism that we take for granted with this drone warfare that's going on, in which some bad people are necessarily eliminated, but in which collateral damage is appalling? What about the terrorism that we impose by our economic domination of everything, which keeps billions of people living in unspeakable conditions? What about that terrorism? That's an example of how convenient, in a way, for us it is to have a wing of Islam go nuts, because then we can comfortably sit back and say, we are free, we're democratic, which is a very unlikely statement, and we're really the good guys. No, we're not. We're filled with rage and hatred, and we've imposed all kinds of terrible things upon the world, and we're strip mining the whole of nature to keep our absolutely unsustainable lifestyles going. So this kind of work is very unflattering, but it's very important.
And thus the title of the book, Dark Gold. What's the gold? The gold is what you experience, what you are able to give, what you are able to feel and become as a result of doing the shadow work. And in terms of the collective shadow, I speak very clearly in this book that there are three things, at least, that the United States has never dealt with. We've never dealt with the shadow of slavery. We've never dealt with the shadow of Native American genocide, and we've never fully dealt with the shadow of being the first to use the atomic bomb on two occasions in 1945. We have not dealt with those three shadows.
And we've never dealt either with the orgy of capitalism that began after the Civil War ended, which blinded Whitman with sorrow. We've never dealt with how that has enslaved the population and made them drunk with consumerism. And we've never dealt with the terrible shadow of our imperialistic ambition, the shadow of empire, which is a shadow I know well because I was born into the British Empire, and I was born into an imperial family that was casually extremely racist, believed that Africans had just come out of the trees and that Indians were a subhuman. And the fact that all these five shadows have never been dealt with is the reason why Trump is now in power.
Exactly.
Why America is now in danger of becoming the single most terrifying fascist state the world has ever known. And the reason why it will be the single most terrifying state the world has ever known is because if it goes fascist, as it very well might, the fascists will have at their disposal unprecedented weapons of mass destruction, a servile and all-invading media, a massive surveillance state which is already in place, and a whole population cowed by an deployed military. This is terrifying. And unless we face these shadows and face the growing shadow of the real threat of a really terrifying fascist state with great power being established here, we will be colluding with the end of the planet.
I would like to just mention one point here that is relevant to what Andrew's talking about, and that is this whole notion of political correctness, which we've heard throughout the Trump campaign. I don't have time to be politically correct. I don't care about political correctness. Let's get rid of political correctness. And there's a wonderful article in The Guardian on November 30th called Political Correctness, How the Right Invented a Phantom Enemy. And this is going on all over the world. It's going on in France and Germany and the UK and certainly in the United States. I'm not going to be politically correct anymore. Well, that's just a smokescreen for, it's fine for me to be racist. It's fine for me to be misogynist. It's fine for me to be imperialistic. It's fine for me to put up a Muslim, you know, create a Muslim registry and ban certain people from this country and build a wall and yada yada. I don't have to be politically correct, which is another way of saying I don't have to be civil. I don't have to be compassionate. I don't have to care about other living beings.
Absolutely. And, you know, even I've had some conversations with people who are like, oh, and I'm talking about people who are really supportive of what they think they are, supportive of this new administration and what's happening, saying things like, we can't afford to be compassionate. And they're caught in this mindset that right. saying, we have to be tough. What does that look like? You know, we have to strike out. We have to be strong or else they're going to get the best of us. And there's this mentality that is so pervasive, and it's so dangerous.
Yes.
Well, it's
fundamentalism.
It's not just dangerous. It's lethal. We do need to be compassionate because it's only through compassion that we can collaborate with others. And really, it's only through collaboration now on a global scale that the human race has any hope of dealing with the enormous problems that it's created. So this lack of compassion, this desire to just thump the other person on the head with a saucepan is actually guaranteeing our destruction as the human race.
Yes, yes.
And it's really at the heart of it, this ability to feel with each other, you know, to see beyond these sort of conditioned behavioral responses that come from an ignorant space, misinformed, and the dumbing down of our educational system and all of this, you know, that
many
of us have fallen victim to with, you know, no fault of our own, but it's just the system we've been brought up into, that we really have to peel back those layers to come back into this heart of feeling with. Like, mm-hmm. even when you're talking about, you know, recognizing other animals, Andrew, like, you know, for me, that was how the veil started coming off for me in the first place.
Yes. How did it happen to you?
It was like, I was all about animal rights, created documentaries, was out there in the front line. Like, it started for me recognizing how we treat other animals. And then that expanded into cosmology and falling in the line, everything we're talking about.
Well, it's very simple. You see, serial killers always begin by practicing on animals, and then they graduate to killing humans. We are now a serial killing culture, and we began the serial killing, and we justify the serial killing by what we treat the animals like. This is the key to the true nature of animal rights. It's not simply that we're sentimental about animals and we love animals and we adore animals. It's because we recognize that if you allow the slaughter of millions of species to take place, but what's going to stop you from allowing the slaughter of millions, if not billions, of human beings to take place without any conscience?
And you know, it's, and I think that we have a habit of turning away, right? So we know, we kind of know it's happening, but we took it.
Habit, it's an addiction to denial, let's face it.
It is. So here we are, welcoming us back.
Yes.
Back into-
but we mustn't get too dark, because I think the most important point that we make in Return to Joy is that all these things are true. We are in an extinction crisis, potentially. We do have these tremendous fundamentalisms to unravel. We are radioactively invaded by the great shadows that this collective crisis is calling up, and we are prey to shadows of narcissism, denial, endless self-absorption, projection of our own golden shadow onto others, doing our work for us. We are prey to all of these, but in our essential nature that is one with the divine, we have the most astounding and very underused resource, which we now need to mine absolutely and to use shamelessly, because on our return to joy and working with that joy depends the future of the human race.
And I would also like to add that because we don't really know what joy is in this culture, we often don't know the many ways we can create it in our lives. And so we have a whole chapter on the many flames of joy and, you know, really guidance as to how to experience those flames to the fullest in our lives and really create joy.
So let's talk about them.
Well, let's do. Okay, so we got a whole chapter. And I can name some of them. The joy of loving and celebrating Earth. The joy of loving all beings as they are.
Yes.
The joy of the arts.
Yes.
The joy of play.
Woo! Yes.
The joy of sacred relationship.
Yes, yes, yes.
The joy of truth-telling and justice-making.
Yes.
The joy of conscious grieving, which we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. The joy of shadow healing. Mm. The joy of simplicity. The joy of stillness. The joy of authenticity. The joy of ritual. The joy of celebration and abandonment to ecstasy.
Yes.
Let us be danced.
The joy of creating sacred space. The joy of creativity. The joy of community. The joy of solitude and rest. The joy of dreaming. The joy of being with and loving animals.
Oh, yes.
You mentioned just a few.
You just mentioned a few, you know, and all of them are striking. And right now I'm sitting with truth telling, because it's not just for me hearing that, it's not just telling the truth, but it's also telling the truth in the sense of what is alive inside of us and what we're feeling. And if that is that pain and that grief and that suffering, and being able to talk about that in an honest way.
Yes. Yes.
It's something we are so scared to do in this world. And that's why the joy of community becomes so powerful, because being in community where we can be with each other in our sorrow and in our pain and ultimately in our joy, but even in the expression of all that we're holding, I think it allows us to, as we were talking about in the beginning, you know, expand and stretch our own capacity to hold all of this.
Yes, absolutely.
It's so important, and for people listening, to just remember what you felt when Carolyn read out those lists, that wonderful, gorgeous list. Because when you read the list out, Carolyn, I felt shoots of joy going into me from all of the different topics that we discuss. I felt the ecstasy of being inspired by great music. I felt the joy I felt when I first saw Zion Park. I felt the joy that I've experienced in through my lovers and through my friends. I felt, above all, the great holy joy that I get from my extreme naughty cat, Jade. I felt all of these. And why we've written the book and why we've made these things explicit is to remind everyone not only that joy is the essential nature of our consciousness, but if you develop what we call joy eyes, you'll see that joy bubbling up everywhere. You see it in the tenderness with which a mother is stroking a child on the subway. You'll see it in old friends embracing each other. You'll see it in the green leaves on the trees. You'll see it in the shining of the winter light. You see it in the beautiful faces of people in prayer in church. It's all around us. We've never needed to connect with all of it, with all of us, more.
Mm. Mm. Just breathing into that. And, you know, in your book, you really do bring in a lot of exercises, you know, invitations to journal into this, you know, to ask yourself, what brings me joy? You know, what are the ways that I feel the ultimate ecstasy of life?
And spiritual practices too, but simple ones that anybody can do. One of the things that I really dislike about the so-called spiritual movement is how overabsorbed it becomes in the complexity of spiritual practices, and right. That's a kind of superior game. The truth is that if you just say the name of God by whatever way you approach God in the core of your heart and say it again and again with devotion, subtle miracles will start to take place. If you just simply embrace the truth of prayer and start praying in your own way to whoever and whatever you believe is the source of all things, you will experience the way prayer changes your life. The truth is that if you do simple forms of meditation, just watching your thoughts from a place of commitment to silence, you will uncover this joy. So let's keep things simple and down home and pragmatic, and we will get through. And even if we don't get through, we will get through, because we won't give up our fundamental human right, which is to be in joy whatever happens. This is the right that's been given to us by God if we do the work. And it's from that joy that we can live and must live now. Millions of us must live now for the world to have any chance at all of thriving, and for the madness and barbarism that's now being raised everywhere not to triumph.
Absolutely. So well said. So much here, you guys. So much that's so important for us to take in and recognize that we cannot move another anything. We can't move a muscle. We can't take another breath without recognizing how we can participate. What is our own way of showing up in our sacred activism, you know, and embodying this joy? And Andrew, for a disembodied voice, you have become so embodied with us today.
Well, my darlings, I have to unfortunately go, but I've been so elated by this conversation, so elated by your response to our book. Thank you so much for understanding this book so deeply and for allowing us to present some of its topics and some of its themes, because our experience is, and it's been an amazing experience, that when people do get to this book, as many, many people already have got to, it's only out month, but we've had the most amazing responses. When people really get to this book, they are so grateful. I was actually in Wisconsin last week giving a retreat on Mary, which is an extraordinary experience. And one of the people there was the leading spiritual journalist of Wisconsin, a fantastic woman in her 70s. She got a video camera and she's going to put it on TV, and she held the book up and she said, "I have never said anything like this before, but this small book could very well be the blueprint for getting through the apocalypse." I nearly fainted when she said that, because that was my secret and Carolyn's secret desire. But with, for someone else who was very hard-nosed and not at all deluded about where we are, to say that in public, in front of potentially thousands and thousands of people, really made me very humble and very awed that Carolyn and I had been given the chance to get a message like this at a time like this out to the world. Yes. And the fact is that we really produced this book in the cheapest possible way so that you get out to the most possible people. So please go to Amazon right now. The karmic consequences for not doing so will be very severe. And order this book and give it to your friends, because if there's anything that people need as we approach the Trump era, it's a book that helps us really stay calm, stay grounded, stay centered, stay joyful, stay passionate.
You can also order through your local bookstore, or there are several online sources, but there are many, many ways to get this book. It's simple, it's practical, it's small. You can hold it in your hand, put it in your pocket, and it really is a manual for getting through these very troubled times.
Absolutely. It's powerful. Return to joy. I want to thank you guys so much for being with us. This has been such an important conversation. And also, you have a gift for us as well. You guys can download it. Andrew's offering the Eternal Wine Poems of Rumi for our time. So it's just a way of feeling the rapture even deeper. And we'll, you know, your websites are here as well, guys, so everybody can check out the amazing work and all of your other writings. And it's all just so important and so powerful. We have to keep the conversation alive and going. Yes. In the forefront of our consciousness.
Yes.
Every moment, every breath, as we step into our sacred activism and, you know, really move our world forward in a positive way. So thank you so much. Such an honor to have you both with us.
Thank you, Val.
And it's an honor to be with you, my darling. God bless you and your work.
Thank you.